domino, on the spot a few black for hands, domino, domino, on the spot a few black for hands. Hello, everyone. I am your host, Robert Stevens, and this is the Black Work Experience Podcast. As you may know, I started this podcast because I was tired of being the only black male or one of the few black people at my organizations. This can be crazy. I was constantly called upon to speak for the black experience or expected to do the emotional labor after blatantly racist things occurred. This is heavy, and it left me feeling fragile, underappreciated, and in need of a change. I began to ask my friends if they ever experienced being the only one or one of the few people of color at their job and the impact it had upon them. We discussed what it was felt like to experience microaggressions and not have a friend or ally to lean on. Balancing the thin line between needing your coins and not being tokenized is never easy. But guess what? You have us now, and we will always have your back. The Black Work Experience explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. We tell the stories of those who paved and are currently paving the way. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. This podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who feel alone. I fully recognize that not all black people think alike. The stories we share on this podcast may seem foreign to you and your experience. However, a lot of black people experience microaggressions daily, and we need an outlet. This is your outlet. I want you all to know that you're not alone. This podcast is for all people, but we focus heavily on black people. I want you to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness, and potential loneliness at work. If you identify with the majority culture, I urge you, listen to the podcast. Think about how you can help your black colleagues when your coworker talks over them in meetings, when people run to the manager instead of having difficult conversations, or when people use racist tropes or dog whistles when communicating. This is important, but you know what else is important? You guessed it, mail time. And guess what time it is? It's mail time! We had a lot of submissions for mail time this week, and I'm asking you to please keep them coming. This submission comes in from LinkedIn, and it's an amazing post that a beautiful sister read and shared with us. If you work in an organization where none of your African-American and black employees or other people of color have spoken in the past 3 weeks about the racial justice movement, protests, or Black Lives Matter, you may be tempted to think that your environment has no problems. That no news is good news. Actually, it's likely quite the opposite. What you should be asking yourself is why, during a worldwide movement for racial equity that resulted in protests across the globe, no one in your organization felt safe enough to discuss it. Y'all, this is heavy. This is deep. And what we're seeing right now all across social media is this company saying, oh, we stand with black lives. You look at Amazon, it's all over. You look at Netflix. But there's another young lady on LinkedIn, and she's actually sharing these Fortune 500 companies who've made these statements that very few people, in terms of CEOs, in terms of C-suite executives, some of them have zero black people in leadership at the organization. And I just want to encourage them, people who work there who may listen to this, if your organization, if your company says that they care about black lives, tell them to put black people in charge of things. Because anything we have touched, for the most part, we've been able to grow and it's been able to blossom. But if you really care about black lives, let's upend this systemic racism and systemic oppression that exists in the workforce that prevent individuals who are black from rising up into the ranks. So please, y'all, let us know what you think about this submission, this mail time. I want to encourage you all to continue sending in your mail time submissions. We can be reached on Instagram at BWEPod. On Twitter at BWE Podcast, and on Facebook at Black Work Experience Podcast. Please continue sharing. And I'm super excited. We're getting ready to introduce an amazing guest. Let's get into it. Thank you all. Let's do it.
Today we have with us Dr. Emmanuel Ungyengiru. Like, I call him E-Money for short. We're going to call him Dr. Emmanuel. This man is amazing. We've been through a lot of things together. And I just want you to take a second and introduce yourself. So, Dr. Emmanuel. Tell us about yourself. Introduce who you are and what you do.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Emmanuel Anyeyurum. I'm a second-year resident in emergency medicine from New Jersey. Went to Howard University for undergrad. Then I went overseas for my medical education at St. George's University in the Caribbean. I'm currently at a hospital practicing emergency medicine as a resident in northern New Jersey.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Emmanuel. Thank you for joining us. I just want to be very clear with people. This is a special moment for me because I've known Dr. Emmanuel, wow, since what, 2011? Wow. So this has been it's been 9 years since, you know, we've met. We've had some amazing nights, amazing times together. This is a person I consider a friend, a true friend. So I'm exceptionally honored and proud to have you on the podcast. Like I said, we go back 9 years, so this isn't just a professional or someone who I don't know. We have deep bonds. So let's talk a little bit about your journey to becoming a doctor. You know, you're one of the people that I routinely talk and brag about because I think the difference between people who are successful and people who are not successful is dedication and their ability to see things through to the end. So talk to me about your journey to becoming a doctor, because from what I understand, there's not too many African-American doctors. Talk to me about your journey.
Thank you for that. I appreciate your kind words. So my journey actually starts in high school, playing for New Jersey. My high school is actually probably one of the worst high schools in New Jersey, notoriously. I actually was not the best academic student coming in to high school. A few things happened in my life that kind of pushed me towards, I guess, using education as a vehicle to, get out of New Jersey. And so one of the major things that kind of made this change was me doing a summer program at Robert Wood Johnson University Medical School in New Jersey, which was a summer program directed towards minorities and introducing them into programs in the health sciences and mostly just like a medical school in my junior year of high school. And so in that program, I read this book called The Pact, about three doctors from New Jersey. One of them actually spent some time in Plainfield. And so it resonated with me because it was someone who kind of saw where I came from and was able to make it into medicine. And so at that time, I would say, you know, not knowing the work that it took to go behind it, I want to be a doctor. So I got to Howard. And Howard University was an amazing experience. I think it changed who I was. I was a very quiet individual. Howard made me kind of come out of my shell socially, develop some lifelong bonds there. But in that, at some parts of that, you know, tenure, I kind of lost my way academically. Granted, I never, failed any classes or anything, like I graduated on time, but I didn't get the best grades that I could have. And not saying that Howard's University education was a part, because there was people who I went to school with who were just focused as soon as they got there and went straight through to medical school. I made a lot of friends. And in that, sometimes I kind of may have lost my way academically. And so when I graduated, I wanted to do something that would keep me in contact with medicine so that I wouldn't lose my way totally, because just talking with advisors and talking to certain people would say, you know, it's not really looking good for you. Maybe you should think about something else. And I wanted to stay so close to medicine that I wanted to envy the doctors that I was around. I wanted to see them and say, I can do this. And so I worked at many doctor's offices, and then also ended up doing research at the National Institute of Health. I did a post-bac program, and then I just had my struggles with the MCAT. And so this comes into where I met Terrell, where we were roommates, and around this time I was still having my struggles with the MCAT. And then at that time I was kind of down because I had did this post-bac program that I thought was going to get me into medical school, and it didn't. And so I was kind of like a little depressed around that time. And one thing that was great about Terrell is, like, a lot of times I would want to, like, be by myself and just, like, sulk. And he would just barge into my room and, like, we just have conversations, make fun of each other, laugh. And so it was kind of almost like a godsend in a way where I didn't allow myself to get too down and just go in that downward spiral of, like, depression, because Terrell was just someone who, like, always would, like, lighten up the mood and everything. So took my MCAT, like, I think the last time, and I talked to a bunch of people whose judgment I really value, like my sister, one of my best friends. And they just encouraged me to just go, you know, go to the island. They saw my mother, my sister was a nurse at a hospital where students from my school rotated at, and she said, you know, it's nothing different. They, you know, I rotated with students who went to schools in the U.S., University Rutgers University Hospital. And it was pretty much, she said she didn't really notice a clear-cut difference in the students. They all seem the same. You know, most students come in thinking they know everything, and they don't really know anything. And so I just went. I just pretty much went and spent 2 years in the island of Grenada. It was good and bad. I think it was the best thing that happened for me professionally because I was able to kind of go away for 2 years. I was just me and my thoughts, just focus and lock in, and it kind of got me closer to my dream of being a doctor and just, like, being around all these people who pretty much all our backs are against the walls, and we're all just trying to be doctors. I think it may have hurt a little bit because that isolation, I don't think that type of, like, isolation from, like, your friends and family is the best for anyone. It's just you and your thoughts alone. And you're just pretty much just kind of ruminating over this one thing, which is becoming a doctor. And it almost becomes like a idol in a sense where it's this thing, like, if this does not happen, then, like, everything I have done up to this point will be for naught. And that's not a really good way of looking at just life in general, just putting all your energy and faith into this one thing it's just a profession, but it shouldn't be something that defines who you are. But anyway, I think that experience was necessary for me because, again, I was focused. I was disciplined, like, right after class, take a nap, get up, go study for a few hours, go to sleep, go to class, do it, like, consistently. It was just like this routine military, like, schedule. Actually, in that period, I didn't make that many friends on the island because, one, I already had a bunch of friends from my experiences from living at Howard and D.C. and even Plainfield. And say that again.
I said, did you?
No, I did. You know my stay, bro. You know my stay. Don't even hate. I isolated myself a little bit, which wasn't the healthiest thing to do. But again, I had one goal in mind. So I came back to the States, did my clinical rotations for the second. Your first 2 years of medical school is predominantly book work, basically just learning the basic principles of anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, genetics, pathology, pharmacology. So you're just learning the basic rules. And then the second 2 years is where you apply those rules in a clinical setting. And you just know, and then you learn that, like, as crazy and counterintuitive to sounds, that there is an art to practicing medicine, or when, like, essentially medicine is a science, but there's an art to practicing it. And that's what the clinical years are about, is just learning that there isn't a one-size-fits-all for everything. And also learning about the whole business and the psychosocial issues that surround the practice and the business of medicine. My first introduction to emergency medicine, I was able to shadow a doctor who was actually the author of the book, The Pact, while I was an undergrad. And so I shadowed this doctor at a hospital in New Jersey, and this was Dr. Samson Davis, who's actually a big spokesperson in regards to being on the front lines and during this COVID-19 pandemic on a bunch of social media outlets. And so he, when I shadowed him, we just did a bunch of everything. Like, I was there for maybe like a few hours, and we jumped in a bunch of patients' room. I think that was the first time we drained an abscess from somebody's foot. It was so many things we did that day. And so I was like, I was intrigued, but at the same time, it was the only thing I saw from a hospital medical standpoint. I worked in a bunch of outpatient facilities during that time, but as far as like in the hospital, it was my first time. And so when I got to medical school, I said I wanted to, you know, I want to be an emergency medicine doctor, but I'm going to give everything a chance. So I went through everything else, and I just gravitated toward emergency medicine. I also had another mentor by the name of Dr. Weef Saab, who took me to the first emergency medicine conference while I was in medical school, just to kind of like see what like the academic portion of emergency medicine was. And when I saw that and things that they were learning there, I was like, yeah, this is pretty much what I want to do. So becoming an emergency medicine doctor in general is very competitive for a multitude of reasons. One is the lifestyle for emergency medicine is shift work. And so a lot of they say that the millennial generation millennial generation, we are big on work-life balance. And so emergency medicine provides that, because you are only in the hospital for a set time of hours. And then once it's time to sign out your patients, you pretty much sign your patients, go home, and you don't get a call. You're not on call.
Oh, this is amazing, Emmanuel. What I hear from your journey, I hear a sense of determination, I hear a sense of dedication, and I hear a sense of you being able to lock in. And I think that is exactly what's needed for people to be successful. I want to shift the conversation a little bit, because we're talking about your journey, emergency medicine, and we're right in the middle of COVID-19. So talk to us. Tell us, like, what is it like being a doctor on the front line of COVID-19? Like, what are you seeing? What is it like? Are you seeing other black doctors? What has your experience been like?
Oh, for sure. I guess I could just trail it back to maybe like 2 months ago. So about 2 months ago, when we first started kind of hearing a lot more about what was taking place in China and everything, it was kind of this thing. It's kind of like one of the, if you ever watch like these apocalyptic movies, or like Armageddon or something, and it's like, you know, the news reporters report it, and everybody's just like very skeptical, like, yeah, I don't know, I don't really see it coming over here. And so the talk was like, oh, it's probably just gonna stay in China, and you know, the virus had a I guess the Chinese people had a predisposition to like getting the virus, and so it was probably something that wasn't gonna affect us like that. And so then, we had, our first patient, And our first patient was, I think, of Chinese descent. And so they showed a picture of him. It actually made social media because he was recording himself in the room. And it was like, okay, so it's just this one guy. You know, it's probably not going to get too bad. Then I think as the virus started to spread, I think around this time it went to Italy and Iran. So as we were interviewing people in the early stages, our screener questions, people who came in with a fever and shortness of breath, was have you been out of the country in the last 14 days, countries including China, Italy, or Iran? And then, or has anyone around you been out of the country in the last 14 days who was sick and went to those countries? And so those were our screener questions, and still, you know, it wasn't too crazy. Then I think there was an outbreak in a nearby city close to the hospital, and then a lot of those patients from that city started coming to the hospital. And so when they were coming in, say that again.
I was saying, like, how did you navigate that? Like, what was it like seeing, like, just being, because, you know, saying you work in northern New Jersey, very close to what a lot of people consider to be ground zero in America, which is New York. Like, what was it like? Like, what was the experience like on a day-to-day basis? How did you navigate that?
For sure.
How are you navigating that?
Yeah, so when the really sick patients, so before we started to triage the patients, there would be patients who were basically anxious, essentially, and they just wanted to test themselves just to see if they had it or not. And we call these patients the walking well. And so the healthcare system was a little bit overwhelmed by all these people who wanted to come in and wanted to be tested. But the thing was, they were healthy enough and their vitals were stable enough where it didn't warrant them not even to be tested, but not even to stay in a hospital. And so these patients would be discharged home. But then when the sick patients started to come in, that's when I just noticed that all the staff at the hospital started to become very anxious. It was this anxiety in the hospital between definitely around with the nurses, the techs, because people were just scared. At that time, when the real sick patients started coming in, a few employees of the hospital were hospitalized for the virus. And so it was just this, like, I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know how this is going to affect me. And people were scared. People were really scared. I think people did their best to mask this fear, but the masking of the fear was almost like a snappiness and an anger almost. It was almost like misguided anger where people were just, I guess, just annoyed, and people were a little snappy at the beginning because they were scared. It was really because they were scared and anxious, not because they were angry at anything. They were just scared. And you could feel it. You could feel it early on.
I want to ask you a question about like the population.
Sure.
You know, data has come out that shows that COVID-19 is impacting Black people at much higher rates in terms of death than it is other ethnicities. And we know that some of the results of that stem from, you know, like just lack of access to care. Prior conditions, prior medical conditions, you know, diabetes, asthma, all of those different things. Did you see that play out for you in your ER? Like, did you see, like, a lot of the people who happened to lose their life were Black people or people of color?
So the thing is the population of my hospital is a very diverse population. It's predominantly I would say Spanish, let me not say Spanish, Latino, and European. So, like, it would be, we have a bunch of Italians in this area, we have a bunch of Polish people in this area, we have a bunch of Albanians in this area, we have a bunch of, we've had, like, some Croatians in this area, we have a bunch of East Indians in this area, and then from the Spanish population, it's a large Dominican population, a large Colombian population, even some Cuban. But so it was predominantly that the black people that did come in would come in from some of the nearby surrounding towns, whether EMS may have brought them in, or that. So it's my view, and I guess, as far as paper population is not accurate enough to say that predominantly black patients were dying, because my hospital, to be honest, does not have, our majority base is not predominantly black. It's predominantly Spanish. But, and so, like, as far as minority is concerned, it's predominantly Latino. I think the county that I live in is I think they say is probably one of the oldest as far as age is concerned. And so the patients that I saw that were having the worst outcomes were elderly European or white and elderly Latino and elderly Asians. Those were the patients that I was seeing that were having poor outcomes at the beginning, and you know, it remains to be seen what's happening now.
So that
media, as far as that data point, I can't speak to that fairly because that's not the population that I've been serving.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about your experience in the hospital, in the ER, as a black doctor. Tell me about your experience, you know, as a black doctor, and speak to it in terms of how individuals who may be experiencing this now as well, or who may be in med school, can look to this podcast and listen to, like, and get some strategies and tips, because, like, you're living what they're getting ready to live. So we know that I did a little bit of research. You know, I try to be on my grizzly. According to the Association of American Medical Colleges, only 5% of medical doctors are black, right? Which that's such a small number. So what has your experience been like in the medical field as a black doctor?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I'll probably say some terms that sound familiar to a lot of people, not only in medicine, but just in general. I think for me, especially my background and how I got to medicine, I come from a public school education and in a lower economic community. I come from not being able to beat standardized tests early on in my academic career. So I think with that, my confidence in that realm hasn't been the highest because of just, I've just been knocked down so many times. You see me. When we were living together, just trying to go at this MCAT thing and everything. And so for me, I suffer from imposter syndrome. I feel like I'm here. I know for certain I bust my ass to get to where I'm at just with the work that I put in. I'm confident to say that if some of my peers were put in the same position that I was in, probably would not be here. I can say that confidently. And even with all that, sometimes I still feel like it may not be enough. And so, a lot of times I would find myself doubting myself. I think that medicine at times, there's times, especially with emergency medicine, when people come in, you don't really know exactly what's going on. It could be a bunch of things. A lot of these things come with signs and symptom recognition, clinical script recognition, just knowing things as soon as you see them, because you're like, I've seen this before. It looks like this. And so, obviously, early on in your career, you do not have that, right? I think I see a lot of the residents who even in their wrongest, even however wrong they are confident in their wrongness. And I've worked with a bunch of residents who have been wrong, like it's almost like so wrong, but their confidence in how wrong they are is something that sells it to a lot of our supervising attendings who are like, okay, I can see that. And I'm listening, I'm looking, I'm like, yo, they are so wrong. And that confidence, I've seen it a lot more in my Caucasian counterpart than a lot of my minority counterparts. And it's just, the thing about it is, like, we're EM docs, like, our job is to resuscitate and just don't kill anybody. Give the standard of care, don't kill anybody. So you're going to be wrong in your diagnosis a lot of times, because when they go upstairs, the hospitals have a lot more time. They can run a lot of tests. They can send out tests that come back in, like, a few days and things like that to get the diagnosis. That's not our job. And so, with that being said, if you're wrong, it's not the end of the world. So and then as you start to see more patients, then you start to be more right. So then that confidence that you had when you're wrong, when you have that confidence, when you start to see more patients and you're right, you start becoming like this all-star doctor that people look to and people ask questions because they think you're this all-knowing being. And, you know, people can't look at that time machine and go back and see that time, all those times that you were wrong, but confident, right. You know? And so it's just something to be said about just having that confidence. I think the residents that do well in residency just early on have that confidence. And I'm not saying that there aren't any African-American or anybody of black descent who don't have that confidence. There's a bunch. Like, I have one of my co-residents. She came in with that confidence. And so I don't think that I think a lot of more minorities suffer from maybe the syndrome. A lot of, and also not only minorities too, a lot of women physicians suffer from this, but not all. And not also, like, not all minorities suffer from this, and not all women physicians suffer from this. But I think getting over just imposter syndrome, I think, is the biggest thing, because does racism exist in healthcare? For sure. Inequalities in female rights exist in healthcare? Yeah. But when you get to that point where you know your stuff, they can't tell you anything. Even if you're a woman, even if you're a minority, if you know your stuff, nobody can tell you anything. And they can't say, oh, he's a, no, it's like, that guy knows their stuff. And so there's a bunch of minority doctors in our hospital that are just, well, you know, just spoken highly of because they just know their stuff.
So I was just going to ask you, because you said something. You said there's a co-resident who came in with you who knows her stuff. Mm-hmm. How many residents in your program are black?
So our program, we're one of the biggest programs in New Jersey. It is 36 of us, and total, there's four of us, 4 out of 36, which is actually not bad. And then I think we're getting next year, so the new class starts in July, and so I think we're getting 2 more, which there will be 6 out of 36 of us next year. That number is obviously small. You just really want to see it higher and higher. But some would say, as far as programs are concerned, that's like next year us having 6 is good. And we all know that we all need to see more familiar faces. And more minorities, more black males. As far as black males, there will be 3 of us in a class of 36. And then there also will be 3 black females in a class of 36, which is equal. And I think our program is very open to hearing about just the numbers and the inequalities and us seeing those numbers. In fact, all 4 of us on my program are part of the diversity and inclusion committee in our residency. And so our job is just basically to kind of get the word out there to a bunch of schools. We went to a fair, residency fair at Howard not too long ago, which I went to, just trying to recruit. We're trying to, before the COVID-19 pandemic, we're trying to get to the SNMA conference and trying to do some recruiting there. And so, my program is different in the sense that they listen to us. This program, the Diversity and Inclusion Committee, was actually started by a former African-American female resident. And one thing I learned throughout my interview process is a lot of these committees are started by African-American women. They have they see this need, and they have been pushing for this. I think, our African-American females have been championing diversity and inclusion because they see the numbers of that lack, especially with the low numbers of African-American males practicing in medicine, and they are, fighting with this fight with us. And I think that's something that has to be said about the African-American females in medicine, seeing this lack and trying to provide some type of balance.
Absolutely. So we're talking about females in medicine, predominantly African-American females in medicine, but I want to switch and talk about, you've seen the term, I imagine you may have seen the term Karen used all over social media. Are you familiar with the term and Karen?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah. So I think that, we've all had our share of experiences with Karens, and I want to know, how do you navigate your microaggressions at work as a doctor, or have you had to deal with microaggressions? What have they looked like? I know you touched on a little bit of the imposter syndrome and other things, and I just wanted to share briefly that, I've been able to succeed and excel and grow rapidly in my career professionally, but I still feel that sense of imposter syndrome. And I'm not sure if it's something that will ever go away, honestly. It's scary because you don't know, but I don't know if it's something that will go away. And so that's something that I think about all the time, imposter syndrome, and like, do I belong here? And having to dispel that negative thought in my head that, hey, what if they find out that I'm not good enough, that I don't really belong here? Yeah. So I just wanted to let you know and let people, the listeners, know that, if you all are experiencing that, you're not alone. People all the way up to, presidents and vice presidents or CEOs of companies, I imagine that they probably feel a little bit of that as well. So hang in there if you're feeling that. Know that you're not alone. Emmanuel is a doctor saving lives every day. He deals with it. I work in policy, and, I'm the last 3 presidential on this particular election cycle, I worked on 3 presidential campaigns from Soda Forum, and I still feel that. So, just know it's not going anywhere. But I wanted you to talk about your experience with, microaggressions, and maybe dealing with Karens. Mm-hmm. Do you have any Karens that you've experienced in the healthcare field? What does it look like? How do you deal with them?
Yeah. I actually had this patient early on in my first year. She was termed a psych patient because she came in. She had a history of like bipolar anxiety disorder. She came in intoxicated. I think she was drunk and ran into like a church, parking lot or something like that. She did something, but she had like a high alcohol content. So when patients come in, this patient was someone who my previous, because I told you we do shift work, so my previous resident saw the patient, and because they were leaving for the day, they have to do this thing called sign out, in which they tell me everything about the patient and what needs to be done, what the patient is waiting for. And so the patient was waiting for her alcohol level to clear, and then also for our psychiatric team to see her to make sure that she doesn't need to stay and be involuntarily admitted to the hospital. And so the patient the whole time was very agitated. Security had to be called multiple times. And she would just say things like, who are you? Like, you're not my doctor, da da da. And obviously I have to take in consideration that, you know, there's alcohol involved, there's a psychiatric component involved. And so with her saying that, you know, I didn't really take too much offense to that, obviously, but you know, they always say there's truth that is in wine, so that may be her viewpoint, but I'm not gonna take offense to that at all. It took a turn in the morning where the patient's mom called, who now when you hear the mom talk, you see where the type of condition or a type of environment this patient was raised in. You realize, oh, okay, you know, this doesn't come from thin air. This comes from just some things that were some nature versus nurture kind of stuff. And so, like, the mom called and just was like, why haven't you called? You can't keep my daughter against her will. I'll call security. And she came in. Then she came inside the hospital. This is the time when we were letting family members to the hospital. She came in. She said, no, we're getting out of here. She's like, I'm going to call. I'm going to report this to the board of this, that, and third. She shouldn't be held against her will. You guys are kidnapping her and keeping her hostage. And all these, this you and calling the security, like this, is all that stuff is very triggering, especially as a black male hearing that from a Caucasian female. It triggers some almost like pre Jim Crow, what's that movie? Rosewood type of like.
Rosewood, yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, it that type of talk, it triggers that type of vibe, and we're to the point where even as a black male with an MD behind my name, you feel very powerless. You feel like you have no power. You feel like it's this word, this woman's word against yours, even though this is like, and mind you, I have a bunch of Caucasian nurses on my back, who got my back, who see everything that's taking place, who see this, who are on my side. You still feel powerless to that voice. And that's something that I'm not even sure if I will be able to get out in my lifetime as far as those types of experiences. And that hasn't been the only type of experience where someone threatened and called, you know, try to, I'm going to report this, and I'm da da da, and I'm calling the police, I'm calling my lawyer, and all this type of stuff. You know, you hear it, you feel powerless against it, and like, this is my position, like, this is where I work. And I still felt powerless.
You know, Imei, I wanna just jump in on that. I think that what you're saying is so real. It's just like even if your tags are good, insurance is good, police get behind you, you still feel nervous. You know your stuff is good, you know what I mean? But you still feel nervous when the police get behind you. I think that that may be akin to the feeling, but, you know, contrary to proper belief, having an MD behind your name, having an MPP behind your name, it doesn't shield us from the racism and the microaggressions that we face professionally simply because we're black. You know, not too long ago, I was in Montgomery, Alabama, touring the EJI Memorial and Lynching Museum. And one thing that I noticed was, as I was walking through, they have painting. They have the, you know, the monuments up that have individual names who have been lynched in each particular county. But they also have pictures up in like descriptions of in words and things. And one picture just discussed how a little kid, like a boy who was like 14, 15, and then there were two. There was a 14, 15-year-old, and there was an older one that said that, oh, this person was lynched because, you know, a white woman felt intimidated. And I can't begin to tell you, I mean, honestly, it's never happened until, you know, rather recently here. But, you know, that was – I had to confront that myself professionally, right? It was jarring for me because, you know, I think anybody who knows me, you know, you spoke about it initially earlier. It's like, you know, I'm a very lighthearted person. You know, and I've worked around a lot of different people, both ethnicities, from socioeconomic classes, and I just never experienced that before in terms of someone saying, oh, I'm intimidated, you know, by this person. And after speaking to some professional mentors of mine, I found out that, like, this is, you know, I don't know if I was naive, but, like, this is part of the course, you know. It's something that happens a lot, you know. And you get placed in this box and in this predicament where it's like, hey, you know, I find you intimidating. And it tends to be, you know, white women, to be very frank, you know, it's white women making these comments across the board. And it literally, figuratively, and, like, you know, unfortunately, professionally, places us at a disadvantage. So I want to thank you for sharing that story, man, that story about, you know, some of the things you experienced. And I want to ask you, you know, just a few more questions, you know, because I think that, like, this conversation we're having right now is important. Number one, we've been able to discuss how, you know, what your journey has been like getting to this place in terms of becoming a doctor, the pitfalls, the twists and turns. And there are people out there who are experiencing that now. So that spirit of resilience, I think, is super important. We've also talked about your experience during COVID-19. We talked about your experience in the actual emergency room dealing with some difficult patients. What advice, right, do you think you would give to people who are coming behind you, up-and-coming doctors, or just people like young professionals who are the only one or one of the few individuals of color who are doing what they're doing? Like, do you have any advice that you can give to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think the number one thing, I think, is early on in your career, is trying to lock in with a mentor. I actually, if I could just name a few names, I wanted to, like, name some of my mentors. Dr. Latisse May Stovall, Dr. Wee Staub, Dr. Franklin Mizell, Dr. Stanford White, Dr. Anthony Watkins, Dr. Samson Davis, Dr. Patrick Charles. There's way more people on this list that I should include, but these are people that first come to mind as far as people who, in this field of medicine, have mentored me up until this point, given me sage advice, kind of told me some of the pitfalls and things that have happened in them in their early on in their career, and how to, ways to navigate against, you know, against it. I think that's probably number one. Don't be shy when you reach out. I've maybe like two or three of those people I mentioned have been cold contacts where I just literally saw them on social, or I know they know somebody who I know, sent a message out, hey, my name's da-da-da-da, this is the stage I'm in as far as like getting into my professional career. I just wanted some advice on attaining da-da-da-da-da. And you'd be surprised, people will respond and will reach out, will check up on you, will put you in contact with people, will let you know of certain events that are taking place. And I think that's something that's the biggest thing, because at the end of the day, other communities are doing the same thing. The only thing is that these people are people who they grew up with. Their parents are doctors. So they're, oh, you want to be a neurologist, a neurosurgeon? Cool. I have a neurosurgeon friend. You could shadow him. And he happens to be your uncle. Or, yeah, he's your godfather. You know he's a neurosurgeon, right? Like, it's these type of things that are taking place. And in order for us to kind of equal the playing field, you have to kind of go out your comfort zone and reach out to these people if this is, you know, if this is your passion. I think that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two is continuing to surround yourself by what it is, whatever it is your passion, because if you surround yourself with it, you're doing two things. You're manifesting it, because everything you do is of what you want to do. And also, you can't get away from it. So even if you want to quit, you can't quit, because all the people you know and everything that you have done up to this point has been focused towards that, what you want to do. And I think I worked at a bunch of doctor's offices while in college and also right after college. Most of my jobs were in like healthcare. So even when I wanted to leave, I couldn't leave, because that was what was paying my bills. And also, he would ask, "What's up with med school? What's up with med school? You should do like." And so it cut to the point where it became annoying, almost. It became annoying when people would ask me about it when things weren't looking, you know, on the up and up. But it still forces you to be, you know, surrounded in that environment. The other thing is just is making a plan. Making a plan and making a schedule, and not only like long-term schedules, but like day-to-day schedules. Like, if you need to call certain people, putting that on your day-to-day calendar. Like, I need to call this person, I need to check in with this person. Okay, cool. I need to read this, that, and third. I need to do this many questions. If you make a day-to-day calendar and then make a long-term calendar, things will again start to manifest themselves as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, those are some solid tips. I'm hearing resource sharing. I'm hearing the connection that you have with people, the mentors, how they were able to guide you and shape you. Man, I think the biggest thing that you mentioned, in my opinion, was just the fact that, like, these things happen very readily in other communities. They don't happen in our community, and that may be why it's so difficult for us to have the success we need, because of the sharing of resources, making sure that, you know, we're touching base with people in our network. I think a byproduct of that, though, is just that we have to continue, like, we started from so far behind, right? Like, we have to continue to grow these networks. I can't imagine, you know, my daughter wants to be a neurosurgeon, and, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to connect her to you, connect her to Ryan, who also, you know, I was blessed to live and stay with two doctors, right? You know what I mean? So
that's real.
That experience. I never worried about dying while we lived together. That experience. That experience has been amazing, man. So thank you. I want to say thank you for joining the podcast. Thank you for being here. Thank you for what you're doing. I think it's so important that when I say we, I mean black people go into that emergency room, they see someone who looks like you. You're able to administer care for them. I read in an article that, you know, black women, well, black people in general, but they say that there's studies that doctors were adhering to that show that black people have a higher tolerance for pain. So that, like, the way they were being treated was different. You know, you think about the mortality rate for black women who are pregnant, you know, with child, like, it's three times the mortality rate of others. It's like, I from what I remember, like, the mortality rate for black women is similar to that of a third world country. And that's a problem. The mortality rate for pregnant black women is similar to that of a third world country. That's a problem, man. And so people like you who are on the front line, who are changing the game, who are providing quality care, no matter what color individuals are, but also having that ability to provide, like, that additional impact because you look like them and you can hear what they're saying and what they're not saying, I think it's super important. And the last thing I'll say, man, I was reading a story. I know you are Nigerian, man. I was reading a story. There was a doctor, a black woman. She was Nigerian. A patient had came into the hospital, and they were having difficulty communicating with the patient. And so she happened to be there. She saw the patient. She walked in, and he began to speak in that patient's language, right, their native tongue. And, like, the outcome for that patient jumped dramatically, bro. And it was just like having that experience, having that ability. I think I want to say they were Igbo, but having that experience and the ability to speak in that native tongue and close that communication barrier and gap is so important. So you're speaking in this native tongue for so many different people, both figuratively, I imagine, and maybe even literally. But I want to say thank you for joining the podcast. Thank you for sharing your experience. And, man, appreciate you and everything you do.
Man, thank you for having me, man. The one thing I want to say as far as this host right here, this is not somebody who talks the talk but also walks the walk. I can call back when I was on the island while I was in medical school and seeing footage of him in Ferguson protesting, him in Ferguson in, like, stores being called the N-word by Caucasian people, and, like, still pushing through even to this day, trying to push through. I remember I used to make fun of him because he got this picture of Martin Luther King, who happens to be one of his frat brothers. You know, wrong decisions. Some people make wrong decisions. You know what I'm saying? Shout out to the dupe. But anyway, I just really, you know, and he always says, yo, I want to be like this person. I want to be like Martin Luther King. And when I say that everything I've seen him do up until this point has been that, I'm so proud. I brag about it. Like he says, he brags about me. I brag about him to a bunch of people. And I just want to let him know I'm proud of him on this big platform.
Man, I appreciate that. That's real love, Mary J. Blige, man. thank you again. You all have a great day. Thank you for listening. You all have a great one.
Thanks for listening to the Black Workers Experience podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. If you want to hear more from me, follow me on IG at BWEPod or Twitter at BWEPodcast. Thanks, you all.
Domino, only spot a few blacks behind you. Domino, only spot a few blacks behind you.